The following episode is brought to you by the American Urological Association. This episode is a continuation of the AUA 2023 take-home messages presented live in Chicago.
All right, next take-home message is increasing representation in urology. Larissa Bressler, Associate Professor at Loyola, and also the AUA DEI Chair, Dr. Bressler.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for still being here on Monday afternoon at the AUA. Sorry for Chicago weather. I'm honored to be the first person and present this first session in take-home messages, increasing representation in urology. Oh boy. I have no relevant financial disclosures. I have some grants. To summarize, we had 5 poster sessions and 1 podium. 3 sessions were on outcomes, and Dr. Murphy will present that. And 1 session was on increasing representation in urology, and there was also some overlap. There was also knowledge sharing session on women in urology issues, implicit bias, etc., and 1 best practice session on improving gender equity for trainees in urology. I'm going to do it a little differently. I'm going to group this by subject, by theme. And if somebody desires more granular look at these abstracts, the numbers are listed on the left. So let's start with pipeline and mentorship. Did any of you know that we actually have decrease in the urology programs in the last 2 decades? Imam and colleagues report that in the last 2 decades, we actually have number of urology programs that has fallen to 67.9%. And back in 2000, 80% of medical schools had urology residency. That means that students of 1/3 of medical training sites lack urological mentorship, leading to obvious disadvantages. Further on pipeline and mentorship, Gao and colleagues from Michigan Urology Academy reported diverse focused pipeline programs. They had 208 students from 104 med schools, had fairly equal male-female and gender nonconforming person, had very diverse background, mostly underrepresented in medicine. 1/3 of participating students indicated they didn't have those home urology training programs that prior investigators mentioned, and 100% of participants reported high degree of satisfaction and will recommend it to others. It was mostly appreciated for finding a mentor, networking, and serving as introduction to our field. Gonzalez and colleague reported qualitative analysis on Latinx urology trainees and once again stressed importance of early exposure to urology, impact of diversity, mentorship throughout residency application process and training years. And there were also challenges unique to first generation trainees, including family understanding of what urology is about. Let's switch gears a little bit on equity and inclusion. There were a couple of abstracts that were well received from Teplitsky and colleagues from AUA workforce posters. And the data shows that urologists have higher burnout than it was back in 16. Although burnout in men slightly decreased, the burnout in women increased quite a bit from 35.3 to 49.2%. The burnout increased most in mid-career and younger urologists, highest in less than 45 years old at nearly 38%, from 38 to 44%, and pretty much the same for 45 to 54-year-olds at 44.6%. So half of women my age in urology are burned out. All right, I'm trying to wake you up a little bit. It's Monday afternoon. Moving on to Holton and colleagues, they reported racial and gender diversity on the AUA and the, I'm trying, and AU guidelines. And as expected, the panel composition of voting members were largely males and whites. 1 in 5 guideline panels did not include single female or racialized individual. and only 1.8 voting members of all guidelines were racialized women or those who identified as women. In terms of European and American guidelines, the gender representation was very similar and lacking. And in terms of racialized individuals, there were slightly more in AUA guidelines. I'm going to move on, not to run out of time. There were also a number of mentions that female and non-white urologists are more likely to experience burnout and differential treatment. Society of Women in Urology census revealed interesting facts that sexual harassment in women in urology was ubiquitous pretty much, and that majority of those who were harassed reported it by patients, but a known fact is that a third reported it by both sources, patients and colleagues, and 60% by physician colleague. Once again, minority in women in urology burnout was higher and was related to work hours and compensation inequities. And Dom and colleagues also reported that there were issues with reproductive experiences in women in urology and maternity leave and lack of these programs. Mm. Finally, in terms of gender equity, Henning and colleagues reported on gender gap in urology and other surgical specialties, and the rate of female non-binary transgender individuals matching in urology was high over the past 5 years. The surprising fact here was that although the match has increased, I would think that we as urology did better than other surgical subspecialty. Well, out of three surgical subspecialty that did worse, urology actually did the poorest. And neurosurgery and orthopedics were other lacking specialties, but urology actually was at the lowest percentile of 12%. And I will gladly turn it over to the next speaker, who has excellent summary of health disparity slides, also first of its kind session today.
Thank you, Dr. Bressler. Our next speaker is Dr. Adam Murphy. He'll be presenting on take-home messages on health disparities.
Good afternoon, and thank you. I am from Northwestern Medicine, and I'm just going to summarize. There were five moderated poster sessions on DEI outcomes and one on best practices improving gender equity for trainees in urology programs. So it was a big turnout. Some under representation of AUA and AUA guidelines is what Dr. Bressler just presented. But similarly, there was also under representation of minorities compared to their composition in the US population across all sets of clinical trials types, from oncology to andrology to endourology. But there were some specialties that did pretty well in terms of meeting their benchmarks, including andrology and endourology for Black and Hispanic enrollment. Some interesting things happened in the world of women's disparities. We found out that there was an abstract by Pakala et al. That showed that there were 30% more ileal conduits given to women with bladder cancer and 41% fewer neobladders. But that their health-related quality of life was actually identical at 3, 6, 12, and 24 months. The only thing that suffered in the body image of women being lower across that time frame. One of the urologists from the audience spoke and said that he thought that it was due to just lower levels of experience of doing neobladders. And women from just female pelvises were more difficult to work in and not as common to experience. There are a lot of disparities seen across race and a lot of abstracts. I highlight a few of them across different disease states. This one on the left shows that there was lower prediction accuracy for biochemical recurrence in Black men when you use a CAPRA or the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center pre-op and post-op scales in predicting it. There was a 1.2 higher hazard ratio of Blacks compared to what they actually would be predicted to have. in Hispanics and in Latinx, they were three times more likely to be uninsured when approaching urologic care. They did not go to the doctor often to avoid citizenship questions, and cited language barrier as a common major concern. In kidney stone definitive treatment, there was several predictors of delay in definitive treatment, and the range was from about 8 to 11 days from a median of 29 days. Hispanic ethnicity, living in disadvantaged neighborhoods, and Medicaid insurance increased median time to treatment for definitive stone management after referral. In BPH treatment, we found out that using logistic regressions that it was very uncommon for people to progress to surgery after they had started on medication. Relative to whites, Asians had half the likelihood of progressing to surgery, and blacks had about 18% lower odds. Hispanics still were statistically different, but only had a 10% decrease in odds of progressing to surgery after initiation of treatment. And then urinary continence was looked at in over 4,100 men from Memorial Sloan Kettering and Weill Cornell, and they found that black and Asian men both had a 37% reduction in odds of having little to no pad use at 24 months, and this was not modified by surgeon, membranous urethral length, age, stage, or biopsy Gleason grade. Advanced prostate cancer had uninsured, so advanced prostate cancer diagnosis in men that were under 55 were predicted by uninsured status, Medicaid insurance, and living in poor neighborhoods. And using the secret shopper approach for new renal mass diagnoses, authors found that practice location in a Medicaid expansion state, higher Medicaid to Medicare pay ratio, and teaching hospital status predicted whether people were willing to accept new Medicaid patients or not. And lastly, there was a lot of nuance in the news about whether people should exclude race from the estimated GFR equation. And basically they found that there were ethical concerns of it because it was based off the idea that blacks were bigger, had more skeletal muscle mass than whites, and so they included that term and inflated renal function by 16 to 21%. However, Su et al. Reported in New England Journal of Medicine that the adjusted equation, including race, was more accurate. So there were some significant changes to people who would be predicted to be stage 1, 2, and 3B kidney failure, and that would impact negatively decisions on people who could receive cisplatin-based neoadjuvant chemotherapy for muscle-invasive bladder cancer, people who would be chosen to be post-op less than 45 or pre-op less than 60 for their partial versus radical nephrectomy decisions, and for transplant referrals for GFR of less than 30. And so one lab showed that cystatin C measurement actually improved the measurements beyond the creatinine-based formulas. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Murphy. Next, take-home messages on transplantation, Dr. Jason Lee, Associate Professor, University of Toronto. Dr. Lee.
Thank you, Dr. Nakata, and thank you to the Scientific Committee for putting on another wonderful annual meeting and for inviting me today to provide you with these take-home messages. Let's see, get the mouse going. Globally, urologists still have quite a large role in kidney transplantation, but over the last decade, multi-organ transplant programs have largely taken over kidney transplantation here in America. So I'd like to just congratulate the small but very staunch group of transplant urologists here in the U.S. that continue to push the urologic footprint in kidney transplantation. We had several great sessions during the meeting. Most of the abstracts fell into one of the three themes of either predicting graft quality, improving outpatient or graft outcomes, or innovation. So I'd like to highlight some of those for you today. In line with all the excitement with ChatGPT, AI, machine learning, Dr. Justin Kim from SickKids Hospital in Toronto presented their work on developing a machine learning model in predicting post-pediatric kidney transplant DGF. Using a cohort of over 400 kidney transplants, they developed over an iterative process a model that could predict DGF postoperatively. The receiver operator curve characteristics were quite good, and while they demonstrated their model had some modest sensitivity and positive predictive values, they had quite good specificity and negative predictive values. Now, obviously this model needs some external validation, but this may, the ability to predict who won't get DGF post-op may significantly change clinical pathways for these patients post-operatively. We also know graft fibrosis is associated with poor outcomes in graft survival. Another abstract from University of Toronto, Dr. Alex Coven, presented their first in human clinical trial looking at a novel imaging modality to correlate graft fibrosis to outcomes. This preliminary work actually looked at pre-implant and post-implant photoacoustic scores of fibrosis, and they were able to correlate this with histologic outcomes of fibrosis, and their correlation was actually quite good. These photoacoustic fibrosis scores not only demonstrated correlation with fibrosis, but they were also able to look at tissue oxygenation and blood flow. Now, obviously, this needs to be correlated with other predictive, you know, tools like KDPI, cell-free DNA, but ultimately they are looking at correlating photoacoustic scores to graft outcomes and graft function postoperatively. So we are excited to see what that data will show in the coming months. There are several abstracts looking at ways we can improve patient and graft outcomes. Dr. Michael Gross from the Cleveland Clinic presented their randomized controlled trial looking at bupivacaine tap blocks on postoperative pain. They included almost 130 transplant patients in their cohort, in their trial that was well matched. Similar to other randomized controlled trials looking at tap blocks, they also showed postoperative pain was reduced, a reduction in opioid use postoperatively. What I found interesting in this study was they included two different incision types. One was the traditional Gibson or modified Gibson incision. The other was an anti-erectus sheath incision. And if you look at the group with anti-erectus sheath plus tap block, almost 50% of these patients had no requirements for opioid postoperatively, which is amazing and obviously important given the opioid pandemic. Even without tap block, their anti-erectus sheath approach alone group had about 16% of patients that were able to avoid opioids altogether. So for those of us, the majority of us that are still doing Gibson incisions, perhaps some food for thought on changing our approach to open surgery, open transplant surgery. In line with some exciting work out of the lung and liver transplant space, looking at normal thermic perfusion and reduced hypothermia, organ preservation, Dr. Alp Center presented some exciting animal model work looking at preserving kidneys at 10 degrees Celsius. Using a murine model, they looked at preserving kidneys at 10 degrees using a variety of different perfusate solutions. And what they found was a significant reduction in postoperative serum creatinine, urine osmolality, but also looking at histology, there was a significant reduction in cell apoptosis and tubular injury. Now, obviously we need to see how this pans out in clinical trials, but this is exciting and may change the paradigm of the traditionally long-held 4 degrees Celsius organ storage and may change how we store and transport our valuable organs moving forward. The incidence of ureteral strictures post-kidney transplants can be quite devastating, very difficult, challenging surgery, has been correlated with poor graft outcomes. Dr. Bravo presented an interesting retrospective multi-site surgery out of Europe looking at patients who developed ureteral stenosis and were managed primarily endoscopically over a 12-year period. And what that group found, similar to other trials, other studies looking at ureteral strictures, that those that presented late, those that had long strictures did not respond well to endoscopic management. But interestingly, this study looked at stricture morphology on fluoroscopy, and they found those strictures that had more of a tapered or what they call duckbill morphology tended to respond better to endoscopic management compared to those that had a wide, flat, concave look. So again, it may give us some clues as to how to manage patients with differing morphology of ureteral strictures. With respect to novel technologies, we heard this morning's vibrant plenary debate between open and robotic kidney transplantation. At this meeting, as well as several previous annual meetings, we've heard a lot about increasing adoption of robotic-assisted kidney transplantation. Now, the group from UC Irvine presented their recent systematic review and meta-analysis, and based on the title of their abstract, they weren't too impressed with the outcomes, but perhaps it's my rose-colored glasses. I sort of interpreted the results in a slightly different fashion. Their systematic review demonstrated significantly less postoperative pain, less blood loss and blood transfusions, and as well less overall postoperative complications, largely driven by, as one would expect, surgical site complications, a reduction in surgical site complications. Now, while they found a significantly longer operative time and a longer ischemic and rewarm time, they did not find any significant difference in postoperative DGF or primary graft non-function, no differences in graft rejection, and no difference in short and intermediate median-term graft survival. So one could actually interpret this as comparable and non-inferior to gold standard open kidney transplantation with the short-term benefits previously described. So I think as urologists, we can continue to push and try to improve our ischemic times, our technique, and perhaps ultimately find the appropriate cohort of patients who will benefit most. Some of the most exciting work came out of USC. Indy Gill and Nima Nasir presented some exciting work as they moved towards a first-in-human trial of bladder transplantation. Some real tour de force work here. They presented their early experience with a sort of a porcine model of auto transplantation. And then they went on to present some work, exciting work on human cadavers. And then more recently, they presented some exciting work on their experience with brain dead heart beating research donors. Again, no real assessment or discussion about functionality or anything like that, but a sort of more of a proof of concept and safety, technical safety study, and they showed some encouraging outcomes. And from what I understand, they are going to move ahead with clinical trials in the very near future. So some exciting results hopefully soon to come from Indy Gill and the group from USC. Finally, I'd be remiss if I did not mention an unfortunate early passing of one of our colleagues, collaborators and friends, Anil Kapoor. After a valiant but short battle with cancer, we lost Dr. Kapoor earlier this year. He has contributed significantly to kidney transplant literature as well as kidney cancer literature. He will be sorely missed, but not forgotten. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Lee. Our next presentation will be on the take-home messages around female urology and incontinence. It'll be given by Dr. Jair Santiago-Lastra, who is associate professor at the University of California at San Diego.
Thank you to the meeting organizers and guests for sticking around to Monday afternoon to hear the takeaways. These are takeaways focused on incontinence in female pelvic medicine. So the AUA 2023 presentations focusing on female incontinence specifically are highlighted here. There was a very interesting array of varying presentations, research presentations, debates, and plenaries. The themes included phenotyping of overactive bladder to aid us in selecting patients who may best benefit from therapies. Predicting incontinence utilizing urinary biomarkers, modifying the risks of incontinence using different tools, optimizing the delivery of office-based therapies, streamlining effectiveness of those therapies, and then also eliminating the inequities in treatment outcomes for underserved women in particular. So let's focus on basic science and urinary incontinence. This is a moderated poster presented by Dr. Chen's group. This is a, in this study, the authors built a diagnostic model with decision tree using the R language software. And then this model actually utilized a machine learning method which automatically generated some cutoffs that would allow those urinary biomarkers to be used to better diagnose test detrusor overactivity from non-detrusor overactivity patients with urinary stress incontinence. The ideal goal of this study was to allow for better characterization or phenotyping of those patients with stress incontinence who also suffer from severe DO without needing to utilize a more invasive method. And this was accurate in about 80% of those patients. Another basic science studies is using a rat model. This is very compelling, using a rat model to implement a macrophage seeded collagen mesh. And the rationale of this study was to see if this therapy could actually enhance tissue remodeling in patients with stress incontinence. So in this rat model, the hypothesis was altering and seeding of macrophages in patients with stress incontinence will help regulate and accelerate tissue remodeling. And so in using this rat model, they delivered these M2 macrophages via collagen mesh, and they found that they were able to upregulate and reduce metalloproteinase expression, and this will in turn limit collagen breakdown, which is associated with development of stress incontinence. And as you can see here, what's in it for our patients in the future, you can see the stress incontinence patient, you could use this M2 seeded collagen mesh with polarized macrophages, isolate those cells, and then use them to prevent the development of the collagen breakdown that we would associate with the stress incontinence. This study was more focused on phenotyping the overactive bladder patient. As we know, there are many patients with overactive bladder symptoms that can significantly overlap with patients who have pain, and they often experience urgency, frequency, and nocturia, and in addition, have pain symptoms. So the rationale for this study was that some patients with OAB experience pain in addition to those symptoms, and we want to further phenotype those patients and identify them. What the studies found from this LEARN network study was that 2/3 of overactive bladder patients in this network actually reported pain, and that the OAB patients with urologic-specific pain, not generalized pain, have more severe overactive bladder symptoms. They also have increased psychosocial issues, and they have higher global sensitivity scale scores. So how does that interplay with how we utilize overactive bladder medications? Another compelling study from the LEARN network utilized deep learning and artificial intelligence, which is currently quite in vogue, to predict response to treatment. So this novel artificial intelligence model was utilized in 243 patients obtained from the LEARN network and categorized in a binary format after they responded to a variety of questionnaires and demographic questions. And then these top-ranked characteristics and clinical features were included to help in the development of a decision-making tool. Some of the, let's go back. So some of the things that they found in this decision aid in this artificial intelligence study was that patients who had prolapse, patients who were smokers, and patients who answered a variety of different questionnaires actually had more likelihood of responding to overactive bladder medications. And in using artificial intelligence, they were able to better designate who may benefit from treatment. In this study, which was using a clinical decision support tool with Delendo et al.'s group, this clinical decision support tool was used to aid primary care physicians, who are often the physicians who first encounter women with incontinence, but are often not equipped to manage patients who have a positive screen for incontinence symptoms. So in this study, the authors sought to develop decision-making tools for physicians who, in the primary care setting, are treating women with incontinence. And so with this tool, they established a multidisciplinary team, including primary care leadership, to develop informatics that would help primary care physicians use a simple decision-making tool to be able to designate what patients would benefit from a referral to a specialist versus what patients could be managed within the clinic setting. And additional tools were provided to these physicians to be able to manage those patients within their practice. And what they found was that it did reduce the number of referrals to specialists and were able to better optimize what patients were clearly in need of seeing a specialist. So that kind of helps in the value-based care model. Another way to maximize our treatment of women with incontinence was in optimizing office therapies. And so vaginal laser therapy has been commonly utilized, though not covered, to treat a variety of urinary symptoms. And so this group, Kovacevic et al., actually presents the longest duration follow-up study for women who have undergone fractionated CO2 laser therapies. But does it work? So actually, the authors found that overall, 46% of patients reported significant symptom improvement. The subjective symptom improvement was actually quite persistent across the 24 months for women who experienced irritative symptoms, frequency, urgency incontinence. But the objective findings did reduce over time, which still lands a question as to whether vaginal laser therapy will be cost-effective or a good long-term treatment to use as an adjunct to the typical therapies that we use for these symptoms. Another study looked at optimizing treatment costs and delivery. And so this is a very timely study that looked at Medicare Part D spending on mirabegron and the implications of the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. So we know that there have been some significant pricing trends in Medicare Part D expenditures. And for example, the total Part D expenditures on mirabegron in 2020 were $1.8 billion. And now, prior to the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, there was no cap on out-of-pocket drug costs in the Medicare Part D benefit plan, and Medicare was actually prohibited from directly negotiating drug prices. That is going to change. Starting in 2026, pricing for up to 20 of the most costly drugs may be negotiated by Medicare annually, and beta agonists certainly fall within that category. Additionally, looking at costs, looking at financial toxicity, this group, Salami et al., looked at the financial toxicity of the urinary incontinence treatments that we prescribe. Although urinary incontinence, we know, is a very financially burdensome condition, which costs the U.S. more than $20 billion annually, the individual financial burden has not been described. In this study performed at a single center, they found that 63% of women with incontinence in the cohort experienced moderate to severe financial toxicity. And when compared to lower functional toxicity severity groups, they found that those patients had more severe symptoms, paid higher out-of-pocket expenses, had lower educational attainment, missed more work, and had higher unmet social needs. And this underscores our opportunity to better describe how urinary incontinence in particular really keeps our patients from being their most productive. Some additional highlights of the SUFU meeting and the SUFU programming was that there was a very large emphasis on socioeconomic factors that prevent our patients from having optimal treatment outcomes from their interventions, as well as frailty impacting oral or overactive bladder utilization and its effects on frail individuals. Additionally, we had substantial video programming. For example, we had robotic technologies that can assist us in mesh complications, and that video was presented by Dr. Popat. We also saw how urologists are using the Aqua Registry to identify prescription trends amongst urologists. We also saw that there's a significant degree of misinformation on urinary incontinence that's being rapidly disseminated on social media. We also want to highlight that in the treatment of urinary incontinence, there is that risk of radiation exposure to our surgeons. The cumulative radiation doses are quite variable, and it does look like there is a significant difference in urology specialists, and we tend to utilize less fluoroscopy, and that is likely related to our specific training in endourology. There was also emphasis on implementation of office-based therapies, the use of vaginal estrogen for genitourinary syndrome of menopause, which also impacts incontinence, and take a look at prasterone, which is coming along the pipeline with some studies showing that it benefits in treatment of recurrent urinary tract infections and potentially also urgency incontinence. The medications appear to be falling into a less favorable category as they get outpaced outpaced by their complications, costs, and side effects. And the patient phenotyping and decision aids really help us stratify our patients into who would benefit most from treatment. And then finally, legislative and advocacy efforts have highlighted a deep inequity level that affects the most elderly, the frail, or the underserved. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode and look forward to seeing you at AUA 2024 in San Antonio.